So this morning, I want to tell you a story. I want to tell you a story that somebody told before me. A story that Jesus told 2,000 years ago, and it's a story I think that maybe some of you have heard before. But it's a story that I'm fairly confident that all of us haven't fully heard before. You see, I think oftentimes Jesus teaches in parables, these stories, these word pictures, to explain something so that you can understand something else. The idea that if you can understand this, then it'll help you to understand that. And so he begins to craft these images, these fictitious scenarios, so that you can begin to understand things that are maybe more difficult, a little more challenging to understand. And I think that oftentimes, because we are so far removed from the original context in which Jesus shared these stories, they often read pretty flat and two-dimensional. It'd be like going to see a 3D movie, but refusing to wear the glasses. You can tell what's happening, and you can see the pictures. Maybe you've done this before. Maybe those 3D movies make you a little motion sick. But you take the glasses off, and it's the movie, and it's flat, but it's kind of fuzzy. And it's only once you put the glasses on that you gain all this depth and all this movement and all this rich texture and substance that you had missed without wearing the glasses. I think this story is like that, and I think that as we begin to put on a certain pair of 3D glasses, we'll understand that there might be far more happening in this story than we first understood or realized. You see, Jesus was having a dinner party, and he had invited two different groups of people to this dinner party. Some of them were sinners, tax collectors, the lowest of the low in the religious social hierarchy. Another group of people that were there at the dinner were church people. They were Pharisees and scribes, the religious leaders. And they were at the other end of the religious and social spectrum and hierarchy. You see, the way first century worked, the way the society worked, is they were governed by their religion and by the rules of their religion. And so the more rules you followed, the better a person you were. You were good or you were bad if you didn't follow the rules. You were in or you were out. You were righteous or unrighteous. And these rules, which were designed to help people grow closer to God, to draw in proximity to God, over time begin not to be used as tools, but as weapons to point out how far people were away from God. You see, over time, instead of using these rules and this religious observance as an understanding of how I can grow in my relationship to God, it became, where am I in my relationship to God in relationship to where other people are in their relationship to God? So where am I to God compared to you? Am I closer to God than you, or to him, or to her? How do I stack up compared to everybody else? There was a lot of measuring and competing. Nothing like the world we live in today. But it was this world that understood exactly where people were located on the social and religious order. In fact, that's how they would design their worship buildings, like this church that we're in. In the Jewish temple, the front of the church where I'm standing, where the choir is seated, was reserved for the religious elite. Only the holiest of people could be in that space. And then out in front in this altar area was where the other religious leaders would be able, be permitted to be in that area. People like Paul Rasmussen and my colleague Arvin McLean here this morning. That's where they got to hang out. They got to hang out in the front here. And then if you were a Jewish male, you were in the room. You could be seated where you're seated today. If you were a female, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to step outside. If you're a child, you're not even outside of this space, but you're like outside of the building, like in the front lawn. And if you're not even Jewish, if you're a Gentile, you're across the street in the neighborhood or maybe over at the SMU practice facility. You don't get to be anywhere in proximity to this space right here. You see, not only were you acutely aware of where you were in relationship to God, but every time you showed up for worship, you were aware of where you were in relationship to everybody else. And nowhere was this more obvious than at a dinner table, because there was this idea called table fellowship. It still exists today in the Middle East. This idea that who you share a meal with is who you share your life with. Who you share a meal with is who you endorse as being on equal status with yourself. If you're a doctor, you eat with other doctors. If you're a lawyer or a businessman, you eat with other lawyers or businessmen. If I'm a pastor, I gotta eat with other pastors. I can't go above or below my social order because that starts to betray the laws and the rules of how society is governed. So, in this story that we find Jesus, in this context, Jesus is a religious leader having a meal with other religious leaders and invites the unreligious people to join the table. And the religious people get all worked up, because that doesn't happen. And the religious people get all worked up and say, Jesus, you can't do that. You're breaking the rules. You can't eat with them. They're not like us. It would be like a high school cafeteria. Maybe some of you have been in a high school cafeteria recently. Maybe you are still recovering from your experience in a high school cafeteria. Maybe some of you are paying good money for therapy because of a high school cafeteria. But nowhere are you more acutely aware of your social rank and place than in a high school cafeteria. If you play football, you sat at this table. If you were a cheerleader, you sat at this table. If you were smart and you study a lot and you were one of the nerdy kids, you sat over here. If you played band or sang in the choir, you were here or there. No offense, choir. And if you were at the bottom end of the spectrum, if you were the uncool kid, you were at the back table by the trash cans, you know, the chairs were kind of broken, that's where you sat. And nobody dared move from one table to another table. That would be social suicide. That would be betraying the social order. If you're a football player, you're not going to sit with the band. And if you're a choir member, you're not going to walk over and sit with the cheerleaders. Obviously, these are broad generalities, but this is how high school cafeterias work, and this is how first century Middle East works as well. Jesus is being accused by the religious elite, saying, Jesus, you're breaking the rules. You're letting people who don't belong at our table to our table. You can't do that. And so in response to these criticisms and these accusations, Jesus begins to tell a story about sheep and coins. He paints a word picture that if you can understand this, then maybe you can understand that. And so he goes on, which one of you, having 100 sheep and losing one, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the lost sheep until it is found? And all of them who were listening at that time, because they understood how the dynamics of shepherding works, would nod and say, yeah, that is what we would do. That is how we would respond. That's normal shepherd behavior. And when you find it, you put it on your shoulders and you carry it home. And then you call all your friends and neighbors and relatives over to say, rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep. Let's celebrate, let's have a party. If you can understand this, you can understand that. Just so, there's more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Oh. Or, imagine you're a woman and you have 10 coins, and you lose a coin, wouldn't you light a lamp and sweep the house, turn over furniture to find that lost coin, and upon finding it, you would call all your friends and neighbors and relatives together and say, let's have a party, I found my lost coin. And all of those listening would have been like, yeah, if we lost something of great value to us, we would do whatever it took to find it. And Jesus says, right. You can understand this, you can understand that. That's how it works in heaven too. You see, I think Jesus' parables oftentimes do two things. They remind us of things that we have forgotten, that need to be remembered, and they teach us things that we didn't know that need to be understood. And I think for Jesus' audience there, there were two groups of people. There was a group of people that needed to be reminded of something very important. And there was also another group of people who needed to be taught something equally as important as well. It's this Jewish word, this Jewish idea, it's called goel. Why don't we say that together this morning? Goel. Now, let's try again. One, two, three. Goel. There you are, loud and proud. Goel simply means to redeem. Maybe you've heard that word before, redeem. We sang it in a song this morning. It appears over 140 times in the scriptures. Redeem, though, originally was not a religious word. Redeem was a cultural term. See, in the first century, they lived in a patriarchal society. The oldest male was responsible for the family. He was the head of the household. And it wasn't a household like we understand it today. It was a multi-family household, a multi-generational household. So if I'm the oldest male in my family, I probably have my brother and his wife and their kids and any grandchildren that they have, and maybe my other brother and his wife and their children and grandkids, and anybody that those grandkids or children marry. Everybody lives all together in one large multi-family house, my house, and it's called the Father's house. Now, since I'm the patriarch, everybody in the family works to earn money, to earn income. And I get all of the money and all of the resources. Why? Because I get that authority and power, not for me, but because as the patriarch, I have one specific job. That is to be the goel, the redeemer. So if, let's say, a granddaughter was out in the field and she was farming, and a band of robbers came by and kidnapped her, it would be my job to leverage all the family assets, all the family resources, to liquidate whatever I needed to liquidate, to go out and redeem, to goel, to rescue that granddaughter and bring her back to the Father's house. It was my job as the patriarch, as the goel, to make sure that the family was intact and everybody who belonged to the family was back at the Father's house. Or if my brother made a poor business decision and lost part of the family farm or part of the family vineyard, it would be my job to leverage all the family assets and resources to go and reclaim, to recapture, to redeem, to goel that part of the family farm. My job as the goel was to ensure the wholeness and the fullness of the family. Now, over time, that cultural term became a religious term, as you can imagine. You see, when God began to move and work on the scene and called human agents to be his partners, he chose a man named Abraham. And he says, Abraham, I'm going to do something unique and new with you. I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to others. I'm going to make you the father of a great nation, so that through you all nations will be blessed. Abraham, you're the patriarch now. You're the goel now. You're the redeemer now. And so I'm going to give you all of my resources and all of my blessings so that you can bring back everyone who's far from the Father's house. But over time, the descendants of Abraham and the people of Israel, they lost the plot. And so what you see in the scriptures is repeating cycle of God redeeming the people of Israel to reestablish them as the redeemers for the rest of the world. Through them, people who were far from God and didn't know God could come back to the Father's house and be restored into relationship with him. And then they'd fall away and not do that, and the cycle would continue over and over again, because God wanted human agents to partake in the redemption of the world. So through that lens, through those 3D glasses, let's look at this story Jesus tells about sheep and coins one more time. Which one of you, having 100 sheep and losing one, would not leave the 99 and do whatever it took to run into the wilderness, mountaintop to valley, searching high and low for as long as it took, with as much as it took to find the lost sheep? And then when you found it, you'd carry it home and celebrate. Why? Because you had redeemed the sheep. You had goeled. You had brought that which was lost back home. Or if you're a woman and you lose a coin, wouldn't turn on the lights and turn over the furniture and lift up the sofa cushions, get on your hands and knees and search to try to find that lost coin. Why? Because your job is to redeem that which is lost. That's why you are in the position you're in. You see, I don't think this is a story about sheep and coins. I think this is a story about shepherds and about women. willing to do whatever it takes to find that which is lost. If you understand this, you can understand that, because as much as this is about shepherds and women, it's about the heart of God and God's desire to redeem everything and everyone back to Him and back into relationship with Him. This verse is so important that we've wrapped the ceiling of this space with it. It is crucial to the heart of understanding what it means to be a Christian. And it was crucial for Jesus, for the people gathered at that dinner table, to understand. Some of you, you have forgotten. Some of you, you need to know. If you feel far from God, if you feel lost or separated from God, God's heart is to redeem everything and everyone, and you are always being pursued by a God who desires a relationship with you. And if you feel close to God, if you're a church person, if you're a religious elite, your job isn't to remind people how far they are from God, to point out all the ways they've been separated, to tell the sheep, why did you wander off, or to accuse the coin, how come you got so lost from all the other 9 coins? No, you had one job. You have one job. That's to participate in God's work of redeeming everything and everyone. Jesus says, religious leaders, quit pointing fingers and start running. Get on your hands and knees. Start looking. Your job is to bring them back home. God has invited us to help that redemptive work in the world. It's not about sheep and coins. It's about a shepherd and women, about a God who wants everybody back in the Father's house. And so, after Jesus told this story, maybe weeks later, maybe months later, he allowed himself to be arrested, beaten, and hung on a cross. And in his final breath, in his final moments, with his arms outstretched, speaks the words, "It is finished," to communicate that once and for all, God's redemptive work in this world is complete. That forever, even beyond the power of death through Christ's resurrection, there is nothing that can separate us from the love of God. That God desires for everything and everyone to be back in relationship with Him. That's why we celebrate communion, which we'll do here in just moments. Because we know that through Christ, through God's sacrifice of His Son, we are restored in our relationship with God. And that there's nothing that we can do, and there's nothing that we can go, nowhere we can go, that separates us from God's incredible love. He is always, always working to redeem us and to bring us back home. Let's pray. Gracious and loving God, we give you great thanks for your work through your Son, Jesus Christ, who restores us in relationship to you. Help us to remember your incredible love for each one of us, and help us to be participants in sharing that love with others. Amen.